Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, Beth Lapidus from Uncabaret talks about moving to New York to share the art of storytelling.
I was just going to go to Washington Square Park where people did their thing. What I didn't realize was that the art in Washington Square Park that does well is like fire eating, or the comedy version of fire eating. It's not like a girl standing in, you know, some arty waif standing in a box she's painted as a house, telling you some stories with a giant book that you don't understand from her deep psychic imagination.
Today on Storyworthy, Beth Lapidus from Uncabaret talks about moving to New York to share the love of her craft, storytelling. Stay close.
Hey, this is Beth Lapidus, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Longtime fan of the show of over 9 years, or you're a new fan, you have a lot of catching up to do. Welcome to Storyworthy. Now, I hope you guys enjoyed the show last week with actor Don Stark. Beth, I'm telling you, this guy, he has 142 IMDb credits.
Wow. You should try just selling those.
He is just stunning. He is a character actor, and he's played on everything from Welcome Back, Kotter, to he was the dad on that 70s show.
He's one of those guys.
And he just does it all. And he goes from detective, to then he does comedy, then he's a cop, and then he's the funny guy again. And anyway, super diverse. So his story last week was about special skills. You know how on your resume it says special skills, and then a lot of people pad that, to say the least. You know what I'm saying? Like, what would some of your special skills be?
Yoga,
exactly. So that's a perfect example.
I do have to say, you should have Tim Bagley, and he has a really funny story about his special skill being horseback riding.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not.
Or rollerblading, or whatever. So Don Stark, he says that he can ride a motorcycle. And guess what?
He cannot.
He gets to the audition, and guess what?
Guess what?
We're going down to the parking lot so we can see you ride this motorcycle. Trouble ensues. So go back, you guys. Listen to Don Stark. The guy is hilarious. But not today, you guys. Not today, because I am here with Beth Lapidus, one of the most interesting people in the storytelling scene.
No.
Because you've been doing it for so damn long.
Ah, that's interesting.
And you've stuck to it.
I guess.
And you always put up a very professional show, and it's always with top-notch talent. It's called Uncabaret, for those of you who don't know it. And anyway, I'm super happy you're here, and you bring forth the topic, the power of storytelling, as if I don't know. You know, I know what you're saying.
All right.
I mean, it's everybody has a story. Not everybody articulates it that well, I'll say that, but everybody does have a story.
Yes, and the story, everybody has a story. I don't know, I think of it as your story is like the thread. I think of it as like your own personal sutra. And your story, your big story, is this thread. And then you have all these little stories. And if you don't know what your thread is, then the beads are just a handful of things that will fall on the floor. And so I think the work of being human in a certain way, and certainly the work of being an artist, whether you're a storytelling artist or an actor, is to know your story. I mean, that thread can change, but it's understanding that thread, which, you know, you can think of as a spine. But I like sutra because it's the yogic word, and also because it's that thing that doctors use to sew the wound. I know it's sort of serious sounding, and, you know, it's thing that I do. But I've just seen so many, and I know for myself that work, and I know for people at Uncab, as I've watched over the years, it's been so interesting being with people over the course of 20 years, 25 years, you know, people like Patton and Dana and, you know, Julie Sweeney and, you know, watching people have a deeper and deeper understanding of what that thread is enlivens and electrifies all the individual stories.
Yeah. And part of the reason why you know this so well is because you've watched a lot of people around you go from beginning to huge successes.
Yes. I would, you know, people always say that beginning, it's not quite the beginning, because by the time On Cabaret started, the people we were working with already were, you know, Bob Odenkirk was coming from Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, but you and, personally.
Yeah, me personally.
Before On Cabaret even began. You know,
oh, sure, when I was a child. Well, yeah, I came here from New York. I wasn't here long before I started On Cabaret. I was here for a couple of years.
Interesting.
Working in the comedy clubs, very unhappily, because I came from the performance art scene in New York, and then from there, the comedy world in New York, I transferred, you know, one to the other. And by the time I came to Los Angeles, I was far enough along that when I went into the clubs, I knew what I was unhappy with in the club scene. Mm-hmm. And I knew what I was looking to address. It took me a few years to figure out, and there's a hilarious sequence of events that I thought maybe I would tell that story, but I've just told that story so many times.
Yeah.
Of how it became, you know, how On Cabaret
became to be, yeah.
Yes, and
but, you know, let me ask you, you call it On Cabaret, but you do sing during it. There is some music.
Yes, and but so the On didn't refer to no music. The On was in response to a night that I was performing at a place called the Women's Building, and you know, when you're a comedian, you kind of know how funny your thing is, and they were laughing a little harder. You're happy, but you're like, I didn't really earn it. And then afterwards, I was like, you know, when was the last time you laughed? And they're like, we don't laugh. We're women. We're artists. We're lesbians. If we go to a comedy club, they make fun of us. So I said, well, you know what? I'm going to make you a show. It's going to be unhomophobic, unxenophobic, unmisogynist. It'll be the On Cabaret. It really just came like that as a response to an audience need, not as a it's not going to have music. I mean, the music came later, really. The music, I mean, there are many years we just had, you know, interstitial recorded whatever music we were interested in. And every now and then Andy Dick would play a song. But it wasn't like musical. I didn't sing in it.
Well, you did do a couple of little piano, you know, you'd
not
sing
in
along.
The day. Not in the day.
I see.
Now, but yeah. I mean, On Cabaret's been running 25
years.
Actually more,
fabulous.
But I'm just sticking with 25.
I think it's so exciting. And let me ask you, do you think also when you're talking about that thread and everything and knowing the thread of your life and stuff, it's kind of like being the quarterback of the team? Because if you're not the quarterback, then how does anybody know what to do? Like, you have to take a leadership
if
role.
If you say so. I cannot. Well, I'm out on the sports metaphors.
You need to make a leadership decision in your life as to what your story is. And then if you do that, which is a lot of people do it through therapy and stuff.
I don't know. Do you take a leader? I mean, in a certain way, maybe.
Well,
you might be. I have to think about that.
Writing your story.
Yeah, but I don't know if it's a... Because in a certain way, I feel there's a sort of a... It's uncovering it. It's not like you're deciding always.
Right, and it's always changing. But like, for instance, what came to mind is Monica Lewinsky. Mm-hmm. She's really busy and she's really active on Twitter now, and she's fantastic. She did a wonderful TED Talk like 6 years ago, but she remains active, and she's retelling her story, helping people of different generations, saying what happened and standing up for it. And mm-hmm. I'm just saying, if she didn't do that, we might have thought... whatever. You know,
oh, she is.
She
okay,
withered
sure.
Away.
Yeah, she's
but
sort
she
of.
She didn't do that. She said, wait a minute, let me tell you something. Here's what's going down, and this is what it is.
I guess I would call that the, what do they call it? The person at the head of the parade.
The leader?
The parade chairman or the parade, you know.
Chairman of the board.
I don't know. But you know, that person in the car at the beginning of the parade.
The grand marshal.
The grand marshal. You're like the grand marshal of the parade of your story. You, I mean, maybe a quarterback. I mean, a million different ways.
Sure,
I mean,
sure.
I think the thing about it is there's always, I met Monica Lewinsky once, by the way.
Yeah.
That was a crazy story.
Yeah, interesting.
I met her at a New Year's Eve party.
Uh-huh. Was she great? Was she sweet?
It was the year that it was all happening. And
oh my gosh, like 97, 98.
It was 2000. It was all happening. And I'm sitting there at this party, New Year's Eve. There are so few people there. We had gotten there early, watching her watch Bill Clinton give the State of the Union on New Year's Eve. She walked in. There were so few people there. And she said to me, she came up to me, she said, hi, I'm Monica. And I was like, hi, I'm Beth. Wow. And it was, she was very sweet, but you know, she had a lot of opinions about what was on TV. Wow. She was very, she's very soft,
so
very
appealing.
She was
only 22, 23 then.
Yeah, very young. I guess. I don't know. I'm so bad with numbers.
You really did see her back in the day.
I saw her in the day. This was after my campaign to make First Lady an elected position.
Oh, I see. You wanted to make the First Lady an elected position?
I didn't just want to. I ran a campaign.
And what happened?
I got as many electoral votes as Ross Perot. It was big. It was actually, it was before the internet was huge. I was in People.
You reinvent yourself over and over. You're so clever.
I guess. People really responded. It started as a joke. I mean, it started, I was doing, when I had a stand-up act, this was before UNCAB really had gotten going, and I had an act, and I said, I'm running for First Lady, ha, ha, ha. And the joke was like, you know, she worked so hard, she should get paid.
Yeah.
But if we're going to pay her, we should get to pick her. Let's pick her, let's pay her. And so then then it seemed like, well, just why don't you just actually do a campaign? And my partner at the time had, you know, sort of interested in politics and was good with press, so he did a press release, and people really responded. And I was, you know, a CNN and People Magazine, and it really caught on. I went to the Democratic National Convention because
Where was it?
It was
year?
In New York.
Wow.
It was amazing, and I covered it. You know, I did like some journalism there. No, more journalistic stuff, and
Yeah, but I mean, was it like on you know, stand up in the street, like
like people, point of view, stuff. It was very depressing. I mean, people don't talk about. I mean, it's very downtrodden, these conventions. I mean, the smell of hot dogs was everywhere.
Yeah.
It was not uplifting. And even though Clinton was winning and it was supposed to feel good, I had to leave early. I mean, it was the thing that really turned me off of politics.
That's a surprise, because I always thought it looked like a party.
Yeah, it didn't feel, not to me, but people did respond to the idea of First Lady. The delegates responded. I had some platforms and, you know, and people were, I mean, it does make sense. I had it all worked out.
Now, what do you think, the First Lady needs to be married to the president?
No, I had it all worked out. There's different wings in the White House, and of course men could run, and they probably will, and then they'll have everything, and you know, all of that.
Hey, listen, I have a daughter. I don't know if you realize that. She's 12 years old.
I detected some childrenness around the house.
Exactly. And I got to tell you, the holidays are coming up, and I'll tell you, her very favorite thing to get is KiwiCo. Super cool hands-on projects for kids to make learning about STEAM, which is science, technology, engineering, art, and math.
Right.
Makes those things a lot of fun.
Oh.
So when it comes in the mail, she gets so damn excited. There's all sorts of crates you can get, you guys, for kids of all ages, 0 to 16. Alabama gets a Tinker crate, and she made this little bird.
Oh.
And it has like these little gears, things, and she spins it, and it's amazing.
Sounds fun.
It is. It's really fun. KiwiCo is a convenient, affordable way to encourage your children to be anything they want to be. And here's the best part. There's no commitment. That's right. No commitment. You can cancel anytime. And monthly options start at just $19.95 a month, including the shipping. And here's the thing, you guys. For my listeners, if you go to KiwiCo.com/storyworthy, you will get your first month free. KiwiCo.com/storyworthy, and you'll get your first month free. I got to tell you guys, this is a fast, easy gift. It's a great present for the holidays. Think of your nieces and nephews. Think of the babies, the toddlers, the children, and the tweenies like I have. All the way up to age 16, you guys. You're going to love KiwiCo.
That sounds fun.
It really is. All right, you guys. Listen, we're going to get to Beth's story in just a second.
Oh,
by the way,
we've
like
told so many stories already.
The power of storytelling, like I said, you wouldn't know so much about it because you've heard so much. You've taught classes. I've read articles that you've written in Medium.com. And you know what you're talking about.
Oh,
so
nice.
This is going to be great. You guys, but before we get to Beth's story, I did want to remind you to follow me on the social media. You know this. I make it simple, at Storyworthy, blah, blah, blah. Also, don't forget to check out my other podcast, Screwed Up Stories, screwedupstories.com, with my co-host, Rachel O'Brien. We're having a great time over there.
What do you do on that show?
At Westwood One. It's similar to this in that it's storytelling, but it's all screwed up stories. And we have women of different generations coming on telling us how they screwed up. Because it turns out, whether you're 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, all of us, it seems, women, we've all screwed up. You should come on the show.
Sure.
We would love to have you on.
I would venture to say that men also have screwed up.
I know, but
but you like to talk women.
We want to talk to women, and we have had a few men on, but we really try to stick to females. So we've had about 50 women on and maybe three guys.
Yeah.
We're trying to, you know, we're trying to create...
They don't
want to
own it?
I'd like to create a world in which other women can see each other in a respectful way.
Oh, that's nice.
In terms of... It is nice. You're rolling your eyes.
No, I'm not. It's nice. I'm saying... No, I was so authentic.
And listen, you guys, check it out.
I don't roll.
ScrewedUpStories.com. And also check out my game show, StorySmashShow.com. Thank you. All right, you guys, she's here right now. Beth Lapidus. She is the creator and host and producer of Uncabaret, like we were talking about. And it is a storytelling show, like we were talking about. It includes music and comedy. And it's currently...
Not, can I say it's not a storytelling show, actually?
Okay, go ahead. Tell me.
It's really a comedy show that is based in stories.
I see.
Like, comedy is the... A lot of storytelling isn't really about the comedy part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I started Say the Word. That was more of a storytelling show.
Yeah.
But Uncabaret really is. I have storytellers coming to me doing, I want to do your storytelling show. I'm like, you're not that, you know, it's really, no, it's not stand-up. It's comedy that looks like stand-up that is very story-based. Yeah. I know that seems vague.
No,
but
it doesn't. Actually, it doesn't at all, because I do both storytelling and stand-up, and I definitely know
it's a hybrid.
Difference. I know the difference, though. It's very clear.
And it's mostly about the now. I mean, I really have people, because a lot of storytelling shows, it's about, you know, coming in and telling that time when, which I'm going to do
like
tonight. I have nothing against that.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. It's a different beast.
It's a different beast. Anyway,
really
not to correct my own bio.
Anyway, you guys, Uncabaret.
They're obviously very bossy.
You guys, it's currently running at the Rockwell Table and Stage, which is a fabulous venue here in Los Angeles, right down the street in Los Feliz. And you've also been quite a writer. Like I said, I've read your stuff in Medium.com, but you've also appeared in O Magazine, Premier Magazine, Elle Decor, Time Magazine, and a number of anthologies. And you've also hosted a lot of daily radio shows. You've had pilots, and you've been a commentator, and you've also, of course, had, I would have no doubt that you've had your own solo show, and you did that internationally, and you're just busy all the time. You guys can find more out about Beth at BethLapidus.com and also on Twitter. Find her over there at Beth Lapidus. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Beth Lapidus.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you so much. This is a story. I haven't really told this story before, but I was just trying to think, what story could I tell you on Storyworthy that what would be the right story? And I thought, what about a story about storytelling? That would be so meta. So this is a story about storytelling. And I guess it starts, I'm in my apartment and I'm writing a story. This is in New York before the millennium, just so you have a picture. I'm writing this story about a girl who saves her boyfriend from a fire. I didn't know where that had come from. It wasn't an autobiographical story. Had never happened to me. When I think about it now, I think maybe I was into the idea of rescuing and being rescued, but not so much into it that I knew that's what I was into. Anyway, I was involved with this hot guy, and I guess I was thinking maybe if I saved him, then he'd fall madly in love with me. I don't know, but I'm writing this story about there's a fire, and I'm rescuing this guy, and... somewhat mystified by it, even as I'm writing it. And so I'm sitting there. I'm sitting at this big red desk. I love that desk. There's this knocking at the door, pounding, in fact. And it's the fire department. And they're like, fire, fire, fire. There's fire. You have to get out. I don't remember exactly what they said. Fire, fire, fire. There's a fire. You have to get out. Is pretty much, I think, what they said. And I mean, even at that moment, I was like, that is so weird. Oh my God. Get out. If that was the end of the story, that would have been weird enough. But here's the thing. Where did the fire? So nothing happens. The building doesn't burn down. They put out the fire. Happy ending.
Wait,
fine.
Where was the fire?
The fire started in the, I don't know what to call it, this was a 5-story walk-up in Little Italy, and there was this little area, this nook, underneath the first floor of the stairs, where I kept, I'm going to call them my big books, and here's what the big books were. I started my career in New York as a book artist. I was, and these books, bookmaking is like a certain form of art, but it's very pristine and very neat. And I started making these books that were gloppy and looked like they were bubble gum and all patched together. But I did really well with them, very fast. They really caught on. And I loved it because as a storyteller, it was like the words and the pictures put together in these art pieces. They were getting shown at like the Metropolitan Museum of Art Library. I was doing well. I mean, they really caught on. But I have this thing about these books that were, I was very young. I was just moved to New York. And I was like, I don't know. You know, what's going to happen with them? I mean, what's the best thing that can happen? They're in these shows. And so what, a rich person's going to buy them? Is that what happens with them? Because you can't even really see them right in a museum because it's only one page and they can't really be duplicated. They're not made for mass production. So what was going to happen with them? And I just was sort of mystified. So I said, I know what I'll do. I'll make them huge and then I'll tell the stories in front of them. So I'll do them as performances rather than as objects.
Like an art installation.
A performance, like performance art, not an installation on a stage.
Yeah.
I'll just do them on a stage. I had come up, I was a dancer, and I just knew I wasn't going to make my life as a dancer. I mean, I just didn't have that body and that drive. And I loved choreography, but I'd been on stage a lot, but not so much as an actress because, I don't know. Anyway, I did it. I made these books. I applied for an NEA with like a crayon. I mean, I really didn't think, when I think now about how much I overthink things and like second guess. I mean, I just wrote this application like in 10 minutes and I got this grant to do these, to turn these small books into big books.
What's it stand for, NEA?
National Endowment of the Arts.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, we don't have anything like that anymore.
Yeah.
We do, but less for individual grants. And so I started making them, and it was a little like a very imaginative world. They still looked like they were kind of falling apart. They were made out of rubber and painted and big, you know, loose kind of paintings. And then I would get and tell the stories. But besides doing it on stage, I had this crazy idea that I would go to Washington Square Park with these books and tell the stories to the people. And that I would give people something interesting to talk about at dinner. That was in my mind. Something interesting to talk about. I don't know why that seemed important, but well, like very Jewish, very foody.
Yeah, but in London they have that thing, like that Speaker's Corner or whatever.
Well, they have it in Washington Square Park.
Okay,
it's a
good.
Big,
and
that I was just going to go to Washington Square Park and do it where people did their thing.
Yeah.
What I didn't realize was that the art in Washington Square Park that does well is like fire eating. You know, or the comedy version of fire eating. It's not like a girl standing in, you know, some arty waif standing in a box she's painted as a house, telling you some stories with a giant book that you don't understand from her deep psychic imagination. You know, it's just like, so, but I, you know, I decide I'm going to do this. So I get the books together. But now there's the problem of how am I going to get them to Washington Square Park from I'm living in Little Italy. Now, Little Italy is important, and I'll come back to that. But I'm living in Little Italy, so I've got to get from there to Washington Square Park. So I get the idea that I'm going to buy a sheetrock transporter. If you don't live in New York, you might even, I mean, I don't even know if they have them anywhere else. But in New York, they have these, they're like shopping carts at Costco, but with a triangle in the middle that, you know, holds the sheetrock up.
I
thought, this is perfect. I'll get one of those. So I go to Canal Street where solutions abound and I get this, sheetrock transporter and I bring it without thinking, where am I going to keep this? I live on the fifth floor. I could barely get myself upstairs. So I, you know, I get this thing. I can't get it upstairs. I put the books on it. Every time I'm having to go to Washington Square Park, guys are saying, can I help you? And as I mentioned, I'm into being rescued and rescuing, and I keep saying yes. So I let these, but every time it's like back and forth. The very first time I should have learned, I get to Washington Square Park. I set up my thing. Some guy comes over and he goes, this is my spot. And I was like, well, I'm here now, so it's my spot. And he's like, no, this is my spot. And there was something about the way he did it that I was like, Oh, okay. I guess this is his spot. And you know, that is such a learning, that was such a learning moment for me of how the arts work. You think, oh yeah, you know, it's like, no, people have spots. You know, people already have all the good spots at that time when you're 21 and you're looking out in the world, you're like, oh, the good spots are already taken. How can I find a new spot? I've got to figure out something. Anyway, so I go off in some corner and, you know, I mean, then he sets up, he's probably making $500 a day, maybe $1,000 a day. Giant. I mean, these people really rake it in. They have giant circles around them. They have their show time. They do 15 minutes. I don't know what their thing is, you know, what their cycle is, but it's 10, 15 minutes. They know how long people's attention is. I mean, it's a real art form, how to sure. make money doing this thing. And he's got it down, and I'm standing in off in some corner where the, you know, jungle gym is, you know, telling story. And I'm making, you know, $10 a day. I don't know what I'm making, you know, change. So I'm living in Little Italy. And I had moved to New York, and I was the first artist to live in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. I mean, Soho was done. I needed a loft, I thought. So I looked in Williamsburg. I lived there for years. Like, I can't live here. I've got to get into Manhattan. And I really wanted to live in Little Italy. I don't know why. And I would walk around the neighborhood. Anyway, one day I walked into the social club. The social club is where the guys who drive the guys, who do the errand for the guy. Yeah. They were like all the guys that were like in the background of The Sopranos. These all guys all hung out drinking espresso at this social club. So I walk in like I just painted with naivete. And I'm like, hey, guys. Like, you can't go in there. And I'm like, hey, you guys. They all stick their hands in their pockets, like ready to shoot me. And I'm like, what? I'm like, hey, I'm just looking for an apartment. Do any of you guys know of any apartments in the neighborhood I really want to live here? And they're just like, no. I had a friend who lived on the block, and he did finally, after a time, find me an apartment that was in the building. There was a candy store on the block, a quote-unquote candy store. It was Lucy's Candy Store. Lucy was real. The candy was not. candy, there was three candy bars in a case that never opened. There was no candy.
So it was a front?
Yes, or a back. I don't know. I mean, it was something else. I mean, you know, there was a payphone that was often used, and I don't know whether it was a write-off or I don't know, a bookie, you know, whatever it was. Yeah. You know, you can put two and two together. Yeah. It wasn't a candy store. Not that kind of candy, at least. And when my parents finally came to visit me in this place, Lucy pulled them aside and was like, don't worry, we're looking out for her. It was the greatest thing. It was the safest block. New York Magazine called it the safest block in New York. So, and her son actually lived in the building. And when she wanted to talk to her son, she would go into the air shaft and just yell up, Frankie! It was so great. Anyway, the super of that building, his name was Michel Bourgeois. And he was the son of famous artist Louise Bourgeois, one of the first women to break through the male paradigm of big art making. She makes these beautiful sculptures that are assemblages, and then they're all painted white or black. She's amazing and something of a hero to me. And this was her son. It was the magic of New York. He lived right across the hall from me, and he was so sweet to me. He was also a cameraman, and his mom was an artist. So he was always, like, you know, helping. And he kept saying to me, you know, you really can't keep your books in the... You can't keep your books there. And I'd go, I know, but where am I going to put them? So I'd go... So, I mean, forget the dolly. The books didn't even fit in my apartment. This is New York. The apartment is as big as this table. I had my mom, when she came in, she was like, there's only one sink. I'm like, oh, I'm only one person. I mean, the bathroom was so small, there wasn't even room for like a tiny sink. It was like that. And you felt like I was inside my own brain because there's paintings everywhere and writing. And it was so great. I loved it so much. Anyway, so there they sat, my books. And there... In these big books is where the fire apparently started.
Wow.
And I don't know, maybe it wasn't the power of my mind. Maybe it was simply somebody threw a cigarette, you know, into the big books. But the fact is that there was some sort of combustion, whether it was spontaneous combustion or caused combustion. It did happen at that exact moment that I was oddly, very oddly writing this story, as I didn't hadn't done before. I mean, I wasn't obsessed with fire. Writing this story about a girl saving her boyfriend from a fire, the fire starts. And it just, I mean, it was a story that scared me. It happened so long ago. I haven't really told it or talked about it because it's a little bit of a scary story in that, in some ways it liberated me because I understood how powerful this thing was that I was interested in. And in some ways it confined me because it made me scared of the power of imagination. And I think maybe made me think, you know, there are things you really shouldn't tell stories about because you can manifest them. And I was married as a young person and my husband wanted to do a story about about a post-apocalyptic future. And it was really one of the first fights that we had. And I said, you know, you can't tell this story. You can't write about post-apocalyptic things because that is what creates apocalypse. And he said, well, this is how I process, you know, my fears and my feelings. This is what creativity is. And I said, no, not really. You have to have more responsibility as an artist. I don't even know who's right. You know, there's no right side to that, but that's where I was coming from. So, and that's the story, you know, the story of fire.
So did you connect it right away then? You know, in other words, you're writing a piece of fiction, right?
Yep.
So you're writing a piece of fiction, and then you're, you know, suddenly the fireman's at the door. Get out.
Mm-hmm.
How long were you out, by the way?
Yeah, it was, you know, maybe an hour or 2 hours.
And
something.
You didn't smell anything?
I didn't, because I'm on the fifth floor, and it was like, you know.
Oh, it's down
And it's down
low.
On the first floor, and it wasn't an enormous fire.
Did you hear sirens?
I didn't. I didn't hear sirens. Or maybe I did. I mean, you live in New York. When don't you hear sirens?
Right. So you hear it all the time.
You're hearing sirens all the time.
You weren't associating that with something in your
building.
No,
and my building, my particular apartment was facing the back and the air shaft. I didn't have a view to the front.
Yeah, so you didn't know what was going on.
No, I just...
So that's kind of scary. I mean, in terms of like, that could have been a lot worse, first of all.
Sure.
You know?
What couldn't be?
So anyway, so you leave, and then when you come back in, they say, and you say, what happened? They say, well, it was this big pile of books on the first level.
Nah, I don't think I talked to I wish I could remember that part better. I would have included it. I don't remember how I found out. Maybe I'll have to go into a deep trance. I'm guessing that I found out from Michelle, the super.
Yeah. And then what happened? Did you lose all the books? Did you lose the
I don't have them anymore, so I don't remember.
But at that time, were they gone then? And that
again,
was the end of it?
Christine, a good question.
No, I'm just curious because
I don't have a memory of that.
Because you were doing it all the time. I mean, going to Washington Park and making this happen. You're so creative. You were just such an artist type.
I am an artist type.
So then when that happens, you're devastated, but then you think, well, I gotta rebuild.
Yeah, I don't even think they all burnt. I think a fire started and was put out fairly shortly, and maybe one of them was burnt, is my guess. It wasn't like a devastation. And,
yeah.
And also, I was so young and had so much young people, that energy you have where you feel like you can just, it will never decrease.
Yeah.
Love that. Yeah. You know, I don't think I thought about like, oh no, my God, I just was like, I don't know, make more. I don't know.
Did you make more?
Oh yeah, I can make more. And then at a certain point, probably not that far away from there, I got tired of schlepping stuff around and
going to different shows and just trying to sell everything on your own, set up the table.
No. There's no table. I mean, just in terms of performing and making performance art, which was really what I was doing, this Washington Square Park thing was like a lark.
Yeah.
But a great learning experience. I mean, it was just me putting myself into a new situation. And I was mostly performing at, like, you know, the Kitchen and PS122
and what were you
dance
performing?
Theater workshop. One person shows.
Was it all true monologues or was
it? Yeah. It was stories from my life, but also ideas and takes on stuff and what is happening in the world. I had one show that was called Crash Course that was sort of me studying particle physics and trying to figure out what, like, how particle physics and life are connected.
What is particle physics? I don't think I know that.
Oh, that's the physics of particle. You know, we're all made of, like, particles and subatomic particles and quanta, and the study of those are the as little as we've been able to break down matter.
Yeah.
And particles have certain ways of behaving. For instance, particles are both, and this is so profound, are both waves and like ball, or they're it's like both a thing and a wave, but they're not, they behave as both a wave and a little ball of quanta of energy, but never at the same time.
Wow.
And there's a thing called the uncertainty principle, which is that as the when you know how fast a particle is moving, then you can't know where it is. But if you know where it is, you can't know how fast it's. There's a lot of like interesting wow. metaphorical stuff. So I did that, and I did something called Having Fun in the Dark, which was probably the most, the first really funny one, and it was like about, you know, I tried to understand the dimensions of reality by like bananas and whipped cream and played Michael Jackson.
Yeah, you are just like such an artist. Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have a brother.
Is he artistic as well?
He is artistic. He is a photographer and an archivist at the Whaling Museum in New Bedford.
Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah. New Bedford, Connecticut.
Yeah.
And so I'm assuming that your parents were artistic people.
No, they were not.
But how did you get the freedom to be so artistic?
I don't know.
I mean,
they didn't discourage it. They were a little baffled. They were like, sure.
How were you affording to live in New York?
It wasn't as expensive as it is now.
Yeah.
I had a day job at a, this was still when there was copy. I started out as a model, I was doing modeling, mm-hmm. like nude modeling.
Yeah. At schools?
At schools and for artists. And then I did some like print work at copy places. And then I got my first NEA grant and I was like, you know, very shortly, it wasn't there that long. I sold ads for a dance magazine for a minute.
It's interesting that
and
you...
And then I just got this NEA, yeah. and then I was just like, oh, I guess I'm a professional artist now, and I never have to work again. You know, and
how
I
much
just,
was it for?
Oh, God, it was nothing. It was like yeah. $5,000.
Well,
but at the
it's
time,
just
it just
well, of course, and you had the wherewithal to sit down and write that.
And it just seemed like, oh, my God, that's so much money. And I mean, then it was more money
it's,
than
sure,
it is
it's
now.
Sure, it's probably like $25,000
right,
now.
So...
Still a good amount of money.
Yeah, and... You know, and I was making some money performing, and I wasn't really making enough money. I was like scraping by, I was eating 2 bean cakes a day. I mean, yeah. you know, it was not a fancy
so then,
life.
But you've continued on as a producer all these years.
Well, the producing, I never wanted to produce. But, yeah. you know, coming up in the art world, you know, you do learn to produce your own work. It's expected in a certain way that you will be a producer as well as an art. You know, the producing part kind of goes with it, yeah. at least until you get to, you know, a certain level. You're expected to, what's your graphics, your postering, you know, all this stuff. You just, I remember learning from a boyfriend, like, how to write a press release,
sure.
you know, and doing that myself.
You don't have a choice.
You just
yeah.
do it. And yeah. you just, it's a very can-do, it's not that different. I mean, in a way, the whole world has become an artist now. I mean, it's not that different than now you have social media and you're expected to do that. I mean, the particulars have changed, but in certain way, the creative class and being creative, I mean, it's infiltrated... the whole of the world is expected to sort of work at that pace. So when I lost these books, I really didn't give a second thought to it. I just kept going. I
mean, that's
I
was very just, mature.
No, I mean, it's just, I was young. It wasn't that much. I just thought, well, there'll be more other things.
Yeah.
And I honestly think I was already at that time tired of the stuff of it. I left visual arts partly because I just, as a human being, I have a hard time keeping track of things. There was too much. I do love making visual work, but there was too much stuff. It
yeah.
was just too much stuff.
Yeah.
So I was just, even then, headed towards a much more simple, I wanted to tour. Touring was the only way to really live and to just be schlepping around stuff. I mean, even once I had, you know, even multimedia.
In other words, making money in different towns.
Yeah,
yeah,
going
sure.
on tour.
Sure,
you
sure,
know,
sure.
going to various spaces and, yeah, just going on tour as one does as a performing artist.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that for a lot of people, that doesn't seem tangible. And it seems like you've been able to reinvent yourself over and over again to make it tangible. And I have to say, like now, in 2019, I think it's a good time to be creative because there are a lot of resources at our fingertips. You know, different, even stuff like making flyers and stuff, you know, like Canva.com or Headliner.
Sure.
All these different resources
yeah.
and they're right there and they're free.
So well, usually $20 a year or $60 a year, but not. I mean, free-ish.
The point is that, like, if you say you're a creative type now and you're not creating, maybe you're not a creative type.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. There's so many choices. I mean, I think the challenge for creative people. I mean, I find this with me is because entering the area of true creativity is a surrender to the mystery and is a surrender to the divine and is a, you know, being willing to be in uncertainty.
And that's be what comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it is to be creative. Mm-hmm. And the other part of it, which is doing the scheduling and doing the, you know, poster and doing the thing, it's so concrete that it's so... You know, there's so much, it's so easy to enter that part of it.
But the nuance comes in the confidence to put it out there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's tough. As I get older, it gets easier.
Oh, that's good. Sometimes it doesn't.
And then a lot of times also for people, you know, if you go through something particularly hard or tragic, then it gets easier as well because, you know, you're more.
Less to lose.
Less to lose.
Once you lose everything, less to lose.
Yeah, you realize, boy, it might not be a.
Do or die.
Yeah, there might not be that many chapters left.
I mean, I do tell students. I mean, I remember I was teaching very young. I was doing a lecture at like the University of Iowa as a young person, as a young artist. They brought me and I had that thing of like, you know, my first, what did they call it? The imposter syndrome. Mm. Like, I don't know. What do I have to? I mean, so I don't know. But I still have the comments from that lecture. I've lost so much, but I kept them because it was like, well, I didn't think I knew. And I just made this amazing effect on people just speaking my truth.
I love
and
that.
I said to them then, and I still would say, if you don't feel compelled to do it, if you don't feel like you have to do it, don't feel pressured to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like an easy... I know there's a lot in the culture. It's like, oh, just everybody should be creative and everybody should like, you know.
But it has to be spontaneous. It has to like, you have to want to.
You have to want to, but it honestly, I think it isn't spontaneous. I think the only way it works. I mean, one reason I said yes to this was it'll be a deadline and I'll think of a story that I haven't told and it'll help me. You know, the creation of deadlines
totally.
And the not working. I mean, most good work happens when you do it when you don't feel like doing it. I mean, I just over and over and over again, I've been telling people, like, if you're not working when you don't want to, then you're not doing it and nothing's going to happen.
Yeah.
Because nobody wants to enough time. I mean, maybe you want to 15 minutes in.
Sure, sure, sure.
But the resistance to it and the, you know, the showing up when the draft isn't going well, on stage when you don't feel funny. I mean, I just time and time again, people come to me wanting help and they're not doing that one thing.
Yeah. And you have no power if you don't start.
Yes, and there's no power if you don't start. Keep going when you don't feel like it.
Yeah, man, I hear you. It's hard. That's the challenge, and that's why not everybody's a star.
Yeah. But also, you know, I don't know. A friend of mine today was social mediaing about, you know, burnout and not giving yourself a rest, and that's others. Everything's like the sweet spot between two. I mean, the key is find the sweet spot between the two.
Yeah.
And then
also to know that what you're feeling is totally normal, totally valid. It will change. It's changed before. Sometimes you just have to get through. You know, whatever it is. You know, I heard a good tip about writing, and it said, okay, so when you're writing, and let's say you've been writing, you set the timer for a half hour or whatever it is, 15 minutes, and then the timer goes off. Keep writing, if you can, until it gets exciting and you really want to write, and then stop.
Yeah, people
because the
say
next
that.
Day,
you know, you're going back to
you
that.
You will pick up faster because you're like excited with that thought.
I know, people do say that.
I like that one.
Yeah.
There's a lot of tricks, you know?
There's so many tricks.
And it changes. That's the other thing. Being creative is it's an art form. It's a life choice. And I guess I'll do, you know, coin laundry forever, but I'm being
Don't put that
creative.
On yourself. Don't put that on yourself. Take that out of the universe. I mean, I guess that's what I think about this story is like, you know, there is this phrase, I take that out of the universe. I mean, I'm really against gossip and I'm really against, you know, shit talking. Even, you know, I have just as much negative talk about myself as anyone else inside my head. And I'm working on it because, you know, it's the worst thing to say it. And it's the second worst thing to think it because, you know, our thoughts I have had other, we don't have time to get into them all right now, but I've had, you know, maybe 10 other examples in my life, very strong examples of thought and talk and manifestation that were very peculiar enough that I know they're not, you know, accidents. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I wish I was more in control. I always say, you know, I have enough psychic ability to have it be of no benefit. I mean, you know,
that's not true.
Yeah.
It's you sort continue of to create so much. Yeah. And your monthly show
Look at this. I just went back. Somebody asked me if I wanted to do a graphic novel. And I thought, I don't know. And I remembered I had this idea. I couldn't remember when, but I knew it was in my files somewhere. I went into my files. I found it. It was like, you know, ancient, like 1998. And I said, oh, I still like this idea. And I'm reading it. And there's a villain in this story named Donald Grump in 1998. So what good does it do?
That is crazy.
But what good, you know, so I don't know. I just plow on and try to, you know, I try to. Try to make the work I'm interested. You know,
you're doing it.
Yeah, I just do it.
You are an inspiration.
Oh, I'm glad.
And you are a fixture in the Los Angeles and the New York comedy scene. And I'm super happy you came on the show.
Oh, it was fun. It was fun to get to, you know, think about this story. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I really appreciate it.
And congratulations on 9 years.
Thanks.
Quite an achievement.
Thanks. Yeah, you're like a show 586, I think.
586? That's my magic. No.
And a fire's in the bedroom.
586. 5 and 8. That's 13. And 6 is 19. That's that's a 10. That's
so funny.
That's a 1.
All right, you guys. I got to wrap it up. I want to thank you so much for tuning in today. Find Beth over there on Twitter at Beth Lapidus, and also at our website, BethLapidus.com. And let her know you like her story. Would you do that? And then tweet me over on Twitter as well at Storyworthy. All right, you guys. I want to thank the sponsors on the show today. Really, you guys, when you check out my sponsors, then you are supporting me. Yay! And don't forget to check out my Patreon campaign as well, patreon.com/storyworthy, and see the different tiers I have going on over there. I can teach you to tell your story, and I can give you a lot of free shows. So check that out, you guys. I super appreciate it. And one more time, on behalf of the very talented and fantastic Beth Lapidus, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
My name is Christine Blackburn, saying make it a storyworthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.